Welcome to Reading by Candlelight at Molly's Cottage, where we proudly celebrate and promote new Australian writers and their stories. I'm your host, Fiona Taylor. Each episode I chat to an author whose book features in Molly's gorgeous monthly book boxes, along with a selection of handmade items that complement the book setting. Reading by Candlelight would like to acknowledge the deep history and culture of Nipaluna, so I pay my respect to the original owners, the Muin and Aa people. I also pay my respects to all First Nations storytellers and their elders. So light a candle, settle back, and let's meet this month's Reading by Candlelight book box author. Welcome, Veronica Lando, to Reading by Candlelight at Molly's Cottage. It's so lovely to have you here talking about your twisty new thriller, The Drowning Girls. Now, how gorgeous is that cover?
Oh, it's stunning. Thank you so much, Fiona. It's fabulous to be here. I'm really excited for today's chat because this is my first talk about The Drowning Girls. So I feel that you're sort of kick-starting the publicity campaign for me, which is really exciting. And that cover is stunning. I love it. I think it looks a bit like an oil painting. Mm. It's really spectacular. I like to take credit for it, but I can't. But a lot of people who aren't very aren't sort of in the book industry, there's a shocking number of people that think that authors design their covers or have a fair bit of input to their cover. So people are always like, "Oh, well done on your cover," and I'm like, "Wasn't me, but thanks."
Now, some talented person created this.
Oh, it's stunning! Yep, they did a brilliant job.
Yes, and I have got my nails match.
I didn't notice.
I took it to the my local nail salon. The ladies there get very excited whenever I bring in a book, and they go, "Are you interviewing someone? Oh, we must match it." So yes,
even I haven't done that. So you're beating me. They look stunning.
I love it, and I love the colours in it. I love the turquoise and this rusty red they've used. It's really striking. Now, before we start, this is going to be interesting because as anyone who's watching on YouTube, if you're listening, it doesn't really matter. You don't really know where I am, but I am in Tasmania at the moment. There is this map here, and we're in Airbnb. I've come away with my husband and Molly's Cottage, Molly and Tom. And so I have got different people to acknowledge today. I'd like to acknowledge that I'm on the traditional lands of the Palawa people of Lutruwita, and I pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Because here at Reading by Candlelight, we're all about celebrating new voices. And so I add my appreciation of Aboriginal stories handed down for generations. Now I'd like to tell everyone a bit about Veronica.
Oh,
yes, I know. Isn't that exciting? I'm going to tell you a little bit about yourself, which you already know.
This should be interesting.
She's an Australian crime author who won the prestigious Banjo Prize in 2021 for what became her debut novel, The Whispering. Veronica grew up in what must be every reader's dream home, above her parents' bookshop in Melbourne. She now lives in Queensland with her husband and three very young children, and is about to launch her second novel, The Drowning Girls, which is also our Reading by Candlelight July book box. Now, remembering that our podcast here is always spoiler-free, could you give us an elevator pitch for The Drowning Girls?
Absolutely. This will be interesting because this is the first time I've given this pitch outside of giving it to like family and friends who, you know, sort of ask you at like the school drop-off what your new book's about. So we'll see just how smooth it comes out. But The Drowning Girls follows disgraced school teacher Nate as he takes up a new job in a remote little fishing town in far north Queensland. And he heads up there somewhat reluctantly. And Nate arrives in Port Flinders, right on the cusp of their annual Drowning Girl Festival. And the festival is really all about celebrating the fishing industry, and it follows this legend that if you sacrifice a woman to the sea, that the fishing haul for the year will be prosperous, and if you don't, then the seas will dry up and the entire fishing industry that supports the town will collapse. Now, of course, it is just a gimmick. It's just superstition. And really, the town of Port Flinders are just using the festival as a bit of an excuse to draw in a crowd from near and far in order to gain revenue to keep the lights on overhead, really, for the remainder of the year. But unfortunately, not too long after Nate arrives in Port Flinders, the real drowned body of a woman does actually wash up on the beaches, and it doesn't take too long for everyone to start wondering if perhaps the people of Port Flinders or someone in town has actually taken the sacrifice into their own hands. And as Nate starts digging for answers, he does start to find that there actually over the years have been a few suspicious deaths, and they've all been drownings, and they've all been women, and they've all happened during the time of the festival. So he starts wondering if maybe there are some sacrifices that actually are needed.
That's a wonderful wrap up of it. I think that it's so much of it is quite unique. Like, I've never heard of anything like this before. And I think that that's one of the special things about this book, is the fact that it is such a unique premise. But you can imagine it happening in Australia.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I want to take this opportunity to tell you what an amazing debut The Whispering was. And because it, I think that it took people by surprise, because it wasn't your average, everyday crime thriller. It had so many different elements in it. And like The Whispering, The Drowning Girls is also about a small town mystery with more than the usual number of twists and reveals. I just can't believe how many twists and reveals you put in your books. It's amazing. I mean, I will talk about this later, but the planning must be incredible. But I want to know, how soon after The Whispering did you begin writing The Drowning Girls?
It's a hard question to answer, I guess. So the Whispering came out mid last year, 12 months ago, and I probably started writing The Drowning Girls only a few months before that, maybe about 4 months or so before that. So really, I had gone through the whole writing process of the first and second draft myself. I submitted that to the Banjo, and then I wasn't really doing much while waiting to hear back from them. And then when it won the Banjo Prize, the moment from when it won to when it was published was quite short, and so it was really full steam ahead and go with the edits for that. And so I was really busy with the edits for that it wasn't until the edits actually wrapped up and were completely more or less finished, or almost finished, it was just the last minute line edit, that I actually started to really think about the second book and started actually putting a bit of a pitch together for the second book to send off to my publisher. So yeah, it was quite a while after I had written the first draft, but probably only just as the editing phase wrapped up that I started to dive quite seriously into the second book.
It really didn't take much longer than say, 14, 15 months.
Yeah, it would have been last year in about March that I think I started, or maybe April, that I started thinking about the pitch. So that was just like the pitch. And with the pitch, it was quite a detailed synopsis that I had to provide. And so I had really planned it out quite a lot. So, yeah, probably from April last year, and now it's being published in July this year. So, yeah, not too long really, I guess.
Am I right in thinking that so your youngest, when did you have them? Were you pregnant while you were writing this?
There's a lot of crossover. So it was probably timed very poorly. And I remember last year always thinking to myself that 2022 was going to be one of those years that in the future I would always look back at and be like, how on earth did I survive that year? So when I found out that I won the Banjo Prize back in 2021, I was newly pregnant. So I was probably only about 10 weeks pregnant or so. And so I was sort of like, oh, so I'm having a baby, my third baby, and publishing a book. So I sort of was, that was a bit of a shock. And, you know, you wouldn't choose to do the two at the same time, but that's just the way the stars aligned and how it was going to pan out. And you're never going to say no to such a fabulous opportunity as getting your book picked up by a publisher. And so the whole editing for The Whispering happened while I was pregnant. And I was actually in the hospital with my two-day-old baby and still editing it. So I was doing some of the final edits with the newborn. So in the hospital with the laptop out when she was only sort of 2-3 days old. And I took it home with me and was editing with the newborn baby. And I think Isabella. She was, I think, 4 weeks old by the time the final edits were done, completely done for the whispering. So that was very exciting. But unfortunately, there was no time to rest because I was right in the depths of getting my pitch package ready to pitch the Drowning Girls to my publisher. So it was full steam ahead, really. And then I wrote the Drowning Girls with a newborn baby, with a little one, and the whispering came out at the same time. So it was a really crazy year last year. I feel like I'm on the other side. My kids are still young, but they're 1, 3, and 5, which is vastly easier than having a newborn, a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. So it still sounds young, but I'm finding it much less of a struggle this year. So, yeah, it was a busy year. Last year was crazy.
It's incredible. I mean, you're like a superwoman. You wrote a book and two books. And gave birth to a baby and looked after her and two other babies while you were, oh my goodness, that's just amazing. I'm in awe.
Oh, thank you. I can't say I did it gracefully, but I did it.
Nobody would do that gracefully.
No. It was always done with like some baby spew in my hair and breast milk on my t-shirt, but it was done. It got done.
Love about you, Veronica. You're so honest. Your Instagram cracks me up. It's so funny. All these, if you haven't been following Veronica's Instagram, you have to, because at the moment she's doing this series of videos where she pretends that she's going to the Drowning Girl Festival, and they are hysterical. I just think it's so much fun. One of the things that I love myself about mysteries and crime is picking apart what's actually happening, as well as enjoying the story for just what it is. And I think that for the Drowning Girls, you really brought your A game, and you should be really proud of that. Because I hear a lot from second-time authors that they feel obligated to recreate the success of their debut novel. And that's not – it's a different book. It's a different book. It's a different story. It's different circumstances. And also, you're a much better writer the second time around because you've done it. And so you're looking at things a different way. And I found – who I've interviewed this year, Danuka McKenzie, her second book was just like, you know, The Torrent was fabulous, but her second book just brought a maturity to it that you felt like it was complete. And I feel that you've done the same with The Drowning Girls, that it's like you actually went into it being very confident of what you felt that you could bring it through. And the confidence that you've had to write something that is a week long. I mean, it starts 8 days before the festival and then wraps it all up. And it's just like, my goodness, there's just so much in such a short amount of time. You must be really proud of that.
Oh, thank you so much. That's really delightful to hear. I've had only a little bit of feedback from it so far from some early readers. So that's such a it's just wonderful. Look, that's wonderful, isn't it? This is every author's dream to get such glorious praise. I am really proud of it, and I'm really excited for it. So because I wrote this book when I had the baby, I wrote it in those little snatches of time where the baby was napping and my 2-year-old was napping and my 4-year-old was at kindy, and it was these little pockets of time. And in the evenings, like, everyone would go to bed, it'd be 8:30, 9 o'clock, and I'd sit down to write. And it was really the last thing I wanted to do. I wanted to sleep last year. I really just wanted to sleep for 100 years. And I couldn't. I was contracted to write this book. I had a deadline, and which was so exciting. And, you know, the Veronica of 12 months earlier would have just been so utterly thrilled for that. And I was thrilled, but I was so very tired still. And so I wrote this book in that real sleep-deprived fog of newborn and motherhood. And I remember handing it in with a bit of trepidation to my editor, being like, oh, my gosh, what are they going to think of this? The first book won a prize. This second book I wrote while I was half asleep. And the feedback I got from I was just sort of waiting with bated breath for them to just be like, Veronica, we can't publish this. But the feedback I got from my editor and the feedback I got from my agent was that it was a stronger and better story than my first book. And so it was such like a weight off my shoulders. And it was so thrilling to hear that. The scary thing is I'm now sort of like, do I write really well under like sleep deprivation circumstances? And do I need to do that for the next, you know, few months to write the third book? And is that just sort of what I have to do to myself to produce, you know, something, you know, of great quality? And anyway,
it's
one of those things I was not confident about, but then everyone, the feedback's been just brilliant.
That's wonderful. Good. It does have a certain dreamlike quality to it.
I would be like at 3 a.m. breastfeeding my daughter and like on my phone because I'd get a little bit of an epiphany, and so I'd start typing notes in my phone. And so that's probably what it is. The next day I'd then type them into the story, and yeah, that's probably where it all came from.
So you did feel that same pressure that especially as you were following up an award-winning debut, that you felt the pressure that you needed to deliver.
So much pressure. The pressure is immense, and the fear and anxiety that comes along with it is really hard to deal with. And now as it's sort of on the cusp of release, it's quite terrifying to sort of let this one go out into the world. So I'm trying to manage my expectations, I guess, and yeah, it's very scary, the second book. There is a lot of pressure with it. You know, there's always that fear that someone loved your first book and then they read your second one and they're like, you know, could take it or leave it. So, yeah, we'll see.
Now, what kind of research do you do for your novels? Because I suppose that growing up in above a bookshop doesn't really lend itself to the wild and sometimes dangerous places that your protagonists inhabit. Now, how has moving to Northern Queensland lent itself to your writing? You know, how does it affect it?
Yeah, I like this question. I don't think I was really asked it with The Whispering. So the first part about the research, I guess I kind of just want to say I don't really do any research. That sounds terrible. I should probably not say that. I think, innately quite lazy. And I'm pragmatic in that I'll, you know, if I set myself goals, I'll do them. And that's sort of how I managed to write a book. But I think I try to sort of choose the easy ways out. And so I've chosen places where I don't have to do a lot of research. So, yes, I grew up in Melbourne, but I've lived my entire adult life in Queensland.
Oh, okay.
I've lived a good portion in north and far north Queensland, a lot in southeast as well. I was on the Gold Coast and in Brisbane for quite a number of years too. But I have lived in Cairns, and I currently live in Townsville, and we spend a lot of our time up in sort of like the rainforest region up here, which is where The Whispering setting came from. And then this time round with the Drowning Girls, I knew I wanted to set it in sort of North Queensland, far North Queensland again, because it's so lush up here and beautiful, and the landscape I think is quite unique to the country, and it's quite varied. You know, we have obviously like the wet tropical rainforest, but then you've got this sort of more sort of just humid, muggy, sort of mudflat, wetland, mangrovey sort of coastline as well. And so I knew I wanted to set it in this region, and I remember going for a walk and just being like, what can the setting be? And we're very fortunate where we live. We're only a few hundred metres from the shoreline, and it's that mudflat mangrove line shoreline. And so I was sort of walking along there just one day thinking about what I had, this like spark of an idea for the story, and I like to have a setting quite early on. And then I was just sort of looking around. I was like, oh, there's mangroves and mudflats, and let's do that. And then I had years earlier actually been up into the Gulf of Carpentaria, which is where The Drowning Girls is set. And so I have spent some time up there in Corumba and that neck of the woods. And so I thought, you know what, I'll just sort of set it up in that little sort of area. It's quite an isolated region of Queensland, and, coastal. And, yeah, so I went for that. So I didn't actually do any sort of additional research. I went off what I had known from visiting that area previously, and then just using sort of the landscape that I've got locally here, which I see every day whenever I go for a walk or I'm out playing with my kids. We're always sort of near the water. But yeah, research-wise, I'm quite lazy. I sort of, you know, I pulled up a few photos of, like, you know, Corumba to see sort of what the buildings look like and sort of see how big the town was and the population and, you know, how many streets there were, sort of thing in the city. But I don't do a lot of research, and I didn't do a lot of research for The Whispering. I like to make it easy for myself as I possibly can.
It's a beautiful part of the country where you live, and I think that it lends itself very much to like the mysterious type of stories that you write.
Yeah, I love using the landscape to sort of drive the plot a lot. As I said, landscape is something and setting is very important to me, and it is to a lot of authors. And I like to come up with a very, very early on. It's one of the first things I have to come up with. And I think I'm quite a visual person. I need to sort of visualize the story and the setting in order. And then the setting itself will actually drive a lot of the plot. We might get to this later about sort of plotting, but I need that landscape to sort of help me figure out what's going to happen throughout the story. So I love how it drives the plot, but it also shapes the characters and how they react and how they behave.
So is that how you came up with the Legend of the Drowning Girl Festival? Just by looking around you and thinking about it?
Yeah, I think, well, actually, it was probably twofold the way the Legend of the Drowning Girl came up. So I had done some, I knew I wanted to include something that had a bit of superstition in it. Similar, The Whispering had a bit of a superstition legend in it, and I liked that and wanted to do something similar for my second book. And so in my bid to sort of come across a story, I started Googling Australian folklore and just read up on a whole heap of different sort of mysterious folklores and legends that we've got around the country. And one of them was the Banshee. So I had a few things in my mind, and so that was sort of there. And then later on I don't know if it was weeks or months later, but I was sitting one night out on our foreshore here in Townsville. We have a jetty, and then next to the jetty, not on the jetty, but right next to it in the water, there is a statue of a woman. And she's called the Siren, and she lights up at nighttime, and she changes colour according to what the temperatures of the coral reef is out here. And so I was sitting there watching the Siren. She was changing colours. It's very beautiful. And it was nighttime, and the jetty was there, and things were lit up, and lots of people milling around. It's a gorgeous part of the town. And I was sort of like, oh, like this looks cool. Like, you know, there's a jetty and there's a statue of a woman, and that's a bit creepy, and maybe I can incorporate a statue of the woman. And I guess I must have had this story of the Banshee, this sort of woman that lurks in the waters, luring people in or whatever it is she does. And it just sort of all mushed together that way.
Oh, things that spooked me the most was the fact that she doesn't have feet.
Oh, she doesn't need them.
I know. The thought of all these little toddlers, you know, putting their together so they can kick them out or in the ocean is just beautiful.
So I love the idea of something being quite a little bit of it's a morbid festival, really. The whole concept of the Drowning Girl is quite morbid. The town lower, this statue, this isn't a spoiler, you find this out very early on. They have a statue of a woman that perches at the end of the jetty, and it's a week-long festival, and at the end of the week they lower the statue of the woman into the water and everyone throws stones at her and she'll sink. And I love the idea of having something that was quite morbid but that everyone got behind and that everyone cheered on, everyone thought it was great. And it's this twisted concept of like, does everyone actually believe in this? Or are we all just in it for a bit of a laugh? And, you know, what, like who here's being serious about this legend? And I love that idea of that sort of, in some ways it's a bit of like mob mentality. I think when it comes to the whole town trying to drown this, it's a statue, but trying to drown this statue, and it's a bit of a sort of like frenzy, crazy thing, and you've got little kids that are in on it and, you know, loving the feel of trying to throw stones at this statue. And yeah, I really like that idea of everyone being behind it, and that it's almost a bit sick and twisted how everyone's reacting and how they're people are encouraging their children to participate. And yeah, it's a bit, I quite like that. And I like that idea of, yeah, just being that whole community's behind it.
I think that it's a little like, it reminded me a little of Halloween. How, you know, especially lately, people have really started to get into Halloween, and I kind of think it's because it brings communities together. And you know, you've got that thing where you can dress up and you can be something different, you can be somebody else. And I feel that, you know, you're not going to throw stones in real life, but everyone can throw stones at her. And so I kind of think that that's where it comes from, that kind of like, yeah, let's get involved, let's do this. And yeah, it's it's an interesting part of human nature that we don't always explore. And I think you explore it in such great detail in the book, but also make it sound like, you know, it's this could happen to you because you could be taken along for the ride with everyone else because you're part of the community. And I think that you did that so well. And also just with the fact that both your books feature male protagonists in The Whispering. So we've got Callum in The Whispering and Nate in The Drowning Girls. And it interests me that you wrote from a male perspective because how did you get the voice so right?
Thank you so much for saying that I got it right. I always have a lot of doubt as to whether or not I did get it right. And I find it really hard to go back and read my finished books myself. That sometimes I'm like, I can't remember if I got that right. So that's great. Thank you. That's great. How did I get them right? Well, I guess when I'm writing, I can be quite finicky with sort of as I write, of thinking of each phrase and sort of like turn a phrase and sentence, and always trying to think to myself, is that how Nate would say that? And is that how he would think? Or in The Whispering, is this sort of the way that Callum, you know, a man who is, you know, in his 40s, Nate is in his late 30s in The Drowning Girls, and is this how someone of that vintage and male and brought up in this environment? So Nate from The Drowning Girls is, so he went to private school and he's now a school teacher himself and he's a well-educated man and he's from the city and now he's in this sort of backwater town and, you know, how would he think of these things and how would he interpret what's going on around him? And you know, he'd probably think everyone was a bit bonkers and, yeah, so I guess I'm quite conscious about when I write as to is this sort of how he would sound and how he would think, and trying not to sort of make it me, who's obviously a woman, and trying to sort of engage that voice a bit more. But I do find it has to be a very conscious thought. Yeah, it's not something that I can just blurt out onto the paper. I have to really think about what I'm writing down for that. But I'm thrilled you said that I pulled it off.
Oh, yes, yes. No, absolutely. I think that especially with Nate, you got his voice so right. And he's such an important character throughout the novel because he's the person that you're going everywhere with and we're seeing everything through his eyes. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that people aren't going to are going to surprise people is then so many twists and surprises in the novel. I was gasping out loud. I was on a plane. I was reading page 83 and I may have applauded. And I know that because my daughter was sitting next to me at the time and I pointed to it and she said she had to look away because she hadn't got up to that bit yet. I'm like, that's got to be a really good bit because look at Mum. But there is so many twists, so many reveals. And I think I lost count because like at the end, they just keep on coming. And I did a little thing about The Drowning Girls yesterday on Instagram, just my recommendation after reading it, and I said that it had more twists than a pretzel factory, and that's what I felt like it was. It was just like you'd get to something and then you'd skew it and you'd go, oh, that was clever.
I love that comment, Fiona. I want to, like, get it on a poster with my book and some pretzels. I love it. I love a twisty read. I love twists, and I love when an author can pull them off and takes you by surprise. And when you didn't see it coming, but it also seems fair, and you don't feel cheated. There's nothing worse than feeling cheated as a reader. I think when you get to something, you're like, really? No, that's, you know, it wasn't coming, and I can't. There was no trail of breadcrumb clues left earlier on in the book. So I think in order to pull it off, you've got to leave. You know, you've got to play fairly and leave a few little clues and hints so that when they get to the twist, you sort of, yes, they fall off their chair because they didn't see it coming, but upon reflection, the reader can look back and be like, oh, yeah, but that happened in this chapter and in that scene and the character said this and, oh, it does all tie together. I can see that now. And so I love throwing some twists in there because that's what I love to read.
It's the same, and I'm so glad that you said that about the not cheating, because there are sometimes that, because my husband and I will often read the same books and he'll come afterwards when he's read it and say to me, they cheated. And he's, I'm go, yeah, I know, honey. And he goes, you should have warned me. Because it's kind of like, you know, don't blame it all on somebody that you barely mentioned for the entire book.
Oh, isn't that the worst? They only come in at, like, you know, chapter 35 and then they're the culprit and you're like, oh, come on, we had no chance of guessing that.
No, that's right. So I'm so glad to hear that. Now, we cannot have a favourite child, but which character did you enjoy writing the most? And I think I can guess this.
Oh, can you? I loved writing. There is in the book, there's a young boy. He's a 12-year-old boy. He comes in pretty early and he has a sort of handful of point of view chapters. His name is Tack, and it's I loved writing Tack. So Tack is this 12-year-old kid who's up during the festival and he's been dragged up by his mum and he doesn't have any mates, and his mum is there on she's working, she's a researcher for the uni and she's doing some research on the mangroves, and so he's sort of left to his own devices for the summer holidays, and so he picks up with some local kids and just hangs out with the local kids basically for 6 weeks of his summer holidays, and we see Tack at the last week of his summer holidays, which is the week of the Drowning Girl Festival, and we see him with these two friends, Burger and Skids, that he's made, and they're these three 12-year-old boys, and Tack is quite he comes from like a private school, and he's sort of like a well-educated family, his mum's like a researcher, and he's thrown into this with this sort of like motley crew of kids that are really rough, you know, they're all barefoot with their mullets and they're spitting and they're swearing and they're nicking stuff from the corner store, and so we're seeing this really crazy festival through this kid's eyes, but then we're also seeing his sort of impression of these new friends of his, which are really different to him. And it's also that sort of really formative age as well. He's 12 and he gets like his first crush on a girl, and it was such fun to write. I loved writing Tack, and I write in a linear fashion from chapter one all the way through to chapter whatever 40 or something, and Tack would have a chapter every 5 or 6 chapters there'd be a Tack chapter, and I would just be racing to get to my next Tack chapter because I'd be like, I can't wait to write this kid. So he was my favorite to write.
I'm so glad that you said Tack, because he was my favorite character.
Oh, good. I loved him.
I really felt for his situation. He's in a new town with friends that are more like bullies.
Yeah.
And falling in love for the first time. He was such a bittersweet character, and you created him beautifully on the page. He was just so believable, and just his what was happening to him during that time. It is so believable. I know. It's so believable.
It was a rough time.
Oh, good. I'm glad that we have the same favourite character. For all our writers listening, are you, now I think I'm going to, I know this one now, are you a plotter or a pantser?
Oh, I think it's obvious, isn't it? I'm a plotter. I'm a meticulous, cohesive plotter. I love a good plot. I've always been a plotter. I think I tried. Back when I first started writing, decided I wanted to write a book, I tried writing without a plot I had a couple of sort of these, I think I did about 3 times where I got to about the 15, 20, 25,000 word mark and would stop, and I didn't know where I was going, and I was sort of like, I don't know what direction to go with, and I'm not confident in the story that I'm telling or that it was the story I wanted to tell. And so I think after about 3 failed attempts of that, and listening to quite a number of author interviews and listening to some of those crime authors that were plotting, I was like, I'm going to try this plotting business. And so I did a lot of research on how to plot and the different types of plotting and structure that you could do. And I tried it, and then I wrote The Whispering based off this plot that I had put together. And I loved plotting. I loved it. I loved having the safety net and like a blueprint to go off. It's sort of like the scaffolding of the skeleton of your book, and then you get to sort of flesh it out and add to it. And I always changed things. Like, you know, I didn't follow the plot perfectly, and that was okay to sort of veer off course a little bit, but I had like this sort of goal in mind and this direction that I was generally heading, and I really loved that sort of that safety feeling. And it also meant then that I could write the books quite sort of fastish. So I would know that, okay, tomorrow I'm going to write, you know, chapter 7, and in chapter 7 I need X, Y, Z to happen. And, it meant then that I could just sit down and do it, as opposed to that sort of staring at that flashing cursor, just wondering what you're supposed to write. You know, I've got to write 1,000 words today, but what am I going to write?
I think it is very obvious that you do plot, because there are, like I said, there's so many twists. That would be impossible. You would not be able to do that because you need to set them all up, and you can't breadcrumb things. I mean, you can go back and breadcrumb, but it's not quite this. It's not quite the same when you've worked towards them. And I think that it is very obvious that you've worked towards those points, because they fit so cohesively into the scenes. So, what advice would you give anyone who's writing to get published?
Oh, great question. I've quite a few bits, but I think one of the ones that hit me early on, like when I first started writing, is to not be disheartened by your early attempts of writing. So if you So my own story is that I sat down one night to write, loved this, and then fell in love with the process of writing. And I wrote every night for, I don't know, a couple of months maybe. And then I put it aside. We moved house. I had to put it aside for a while. And I came back and read it with fresh eyes, and it was hideous. So, so bad. I should have burnt my laptop immediately. The writing was appalling. But at the time, I had thought it was great. And I was so confident diving back into the story to read it that I thought it was going to be brilliant. And it was such a slap in the face that it wasn't. But I didn't get disheartened by that. Instead, I held on to the idea of how it had made me feel to sit down and write each night. And I had absolutely adored writing. It had just been this glorious outlet for me, and I'd loved it. And I was so keen to get back into it. And that month or so where we were moving house and I wasn't writing, I had these itchy fingers to get back into it. And so instead I decided I had to sort of hone the craft of writing. And so I learned how to write instead. And I just think, yeah, not to, it would be really easy, I think, to be discouraged by a poor early attempt, and to sort of, if someone gives you some negative feedback maybe in the early stages, or if you read something that you've written and go, oh, actually it's not very good. If you love writing, I think just ignore that, and or figure out why it's not very good, and then move on from there.
Yes, I love your blog that where you talk about learning how to write and the craft of writing, and how if you can learn how to write, then everybody can learn how to write. I just think, but ideas that you put across are really useful. I mean, writers can put those in place and feel that they're achieving something. And so I've loved reading that series of yours.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks. You don't have to use your time to help others. So I think it's really worthy to mention how wonderful it is that you've done that, because it is important for people out there who are writing and are wondering whether or not to keep on going. But stories like yours gives them inspiration, and and I think that that's a wonderful thing. Now,
thank you.
Welcome. Now, for all our readers out there, can you recommend a book by an Australian author that you've read recently and would recommend? And yes, you can have more than one.
I've got multiples. Okay, the first one I'm going to show you is this one. I read it probably about 12 months ago, but oh my giddy aunt. It is Denizen by James Mackenzie Watson. He won the Penguin Literary Prize last year for it's considered a literary thriller. And it's sort of like a nod to mental health in Western New South Wales, in that regional sort of dry, dusty regional area, rural area. And it follows a young boy, Parker, and it follows him through this journey up from being a child up through to being an adult and being a father himself. And it's very confronting and quite shocking. And there is this massive twist at the end, and it's one of those twists that will really punch you in the gut, and it will leave you, I read it about 12 months ago, and I still think about it, and it was one of those ones that you almost feel a bit sick when you read it. And so he'll really get you there. But the writing, I mean, he won the literary prize for a reason. The writing is beautiful. It's superb, and it's almost lyrical, and it just rolls off the tongue, and it's just beautiful. This is a beautiful book, and he's actually a great guy. I met him last year in Sydney, and he's just a beautiful human. So highly recommend. I'm going to give a shout out to Mercedes Mercier as well. I know you had her on last month, and so a lot of people will, your listeners will already be all over Mercedes' new book, Black Lives. But this is only her second book, and she writes like a seasoned pro. I fell off my perch reading this one. I was just like, what on earth is this girl doing? She's brilliant. She doesn't write like someone who's only publishing her second book. it's very crisp. The prose are very clear and tight, and the depth she goes to dive into the main character and to give you her sort of her backstory without laying it on too thick, because this is it's her second book and it's got the same character in White Noise as it does in Black Lies, but you can read this as a standalone. And I felt like I was in very capable hands reading Sadie's book. So there's that one. Final book, I promise, last one, very quick. This one, I did read it a little while ago. It's one of those ones you just keep thinking about. So this is The Silent Listener by Lynn Yawit. I'm not sure how to pronounce her surname. She's a delightful woman. I haven't met her, but I've had a chat to her before. And it's quite a chilling story because I think it's loosely based off her own childhood. And it's very confronting. And it is one of those ones that it's got a few little twists in it as well as a bit of a tried and tested mystery that we all love, and you can sort of try and solve the mystery as well as being a bit twisty at the same time. So that one's, it's one of those ones that you will be left thinking about for a long time. You won't forget it. It's one of those ones you won't forget. Yeah. So I recommend those ones.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And yes, I do. I agree about Mercedes' book.
I feel she's very ahead of her game. Like she's switched on and I was very surprised reading it. I was like, I didn't expect to leave this high.
And I've also met Lynn. She's such a lovely, generous
she's person. She's very generous, yes.
But they're three amazing books by three amazing Australian authors. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. And all fairly new authors as well, in the spirit of recognising new Australian talent. We've got some amazing ones coming out of the works now, I think.
I think that there's just so much talent in Australia. Why do we need to go elsewhere to look for our books? Now, if you were casting the movie of your book, who would you like to play Nat and Irina?
Now, I knew you were going to ask this question, and I don't even have a good answer for you. So I know I said I was a very visual person earlier when I was like thinking of setting, but when it comes to my characters, I can picture them in my head, but I never sort of affiliate them with an actual actor. And I did the same with The Whispering. Someone asked me once who I would cast, and I was like, I don't know. And so I did do a little bit of like thinking of which actors do I like and who would fit him well. And Nate is he's quite a big guy, like quite broad and bulky. But I do like, and I think he's of the right sort of age, Sam Worthington. And I thought he might make a good Nate. And then for Irina is, for your listeners, is a sort of mid-20s woman. She works as the barmaid at the local bistro, and she's quite funky and out there, and she doesn't take any rubbish from anyone, a bit of a no-nonsense sort of woman. And I was kind of, I don't know, but I kind of fell on Catherine Langford, maybe. She's a young actress. I think she's Aussie. I'm pretty sure she's Aussie or Kiwi.
She's Australian. Yeah.
She's Australian. She played the lead role in that Netflix series 13 Reasons Why, which is that very confronting.
Brilliant
and very confronting show. And I thought her, with her hair chopped off and a sort of dye peroxide blonde like Irina, so I was like, she might have the right sort of sass for someone like Irina. Yeah.
They are very good suggestions because usually
I've racked my brain.
Oh, they're so good because usually I get crickets when I ask people that question, but it's one of my favourite questions. Okay, Sam Worthington is a really good choice. I was thinking the most underrated of the Hemsworths, big brother Luke from Westworld, because he kind of has that physical presence. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking for Irina, Millie Alcock, who's she's in Upright and House of the Dragon, and she's very blonde and very, and she's kind of got that kind of sassy attitude thing too. But yeah, Catherine would be brilliant as well, because she's both amazing actors, so all amazing actors. So yes, so keep an eye out, folks, the Drowning Girls movie coming to you soon.
Just pick up the book first. I love your positive attitude for it, Fiona. Fabulous.
Now, I'm very excited for your next book. Is there anything you can tell us about it and how soon we can expect it?
Oh, great question. Well, I am contracted to write a third book, so that's incredibly exciting. So I am sort of working away at one. I can't tell you too much about it. I can tell you it's another crime mystery again, a thriller. I'm hoping for it to be a little bit faster paced. I'm going for a female lead this time, so that's very different for me, and I'm incredibly excited to write a woman main character this time around. And it'll be a little bit of a different setting, so it won't sort of be in that far north Queensland. And it's both the Whispering and the Drowning Girls were sort of set in these little tiny towns, sort of backwater towns that are just in the middle of nowhere. And the setting for book three is going to be a little bit more sort of luxurious, so a little bit different for me. Yeah, but still that same sort of thriller, crime, mystery genre. I'm loving the idea
of a resort.
Something a bit. I was thinking, you know what, I've written about these sort of little impoverished towns a couple of times now. I'm ready for something a bit different, a little bit more fresh. And so I'm very excited. So sort of publication date, not set in stone, but maybe either somewhere sort of between 12 to 18 months from now is ballpark figure.
Fabulous. That's exciting.
It's really exciting.
Congratulations, Veronica. The Drowning Girls is such a twisty and atmospheric mystery thriller. It was not only difficult to put down, but it had me thinking about it long after I turned the final page. So I want to thank HarperCollins, because they sent me a copy of The Drowning Girls, which allowed me to read it before our interview. So I really appreciate that. And finally, on behalf of Molly, of Reading by Candlelight at Molly's Cottage, I want to thank you for being our July book box author. Mm-hmm. I know that everyone who has ordered this book box is going to love your book as much as I have, but as well as enjoying the treats that accompany it. Now, we wish you all the best for the Drowning Girls publication on 5th of July. And if anyone lives up north, please go to the launch, because we wish we could be there to celebrate with you. But it is a long way to go.
It's a long way away, isn't it?
But I hope that you know that Molly and I will be there in spirit, wishing you and your wonderful book the very best.
Thank you so very much, and thank you for having me on and for being my first interview for The Drowning Girls. It's been an absolute thrill to chat to you, Fiona.
And I'm so excited that we were your first interview. That's wonderful. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you today, Veronica. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for visiting Molly's Cottage, home of the Reading by Candlelight Book Box, the only book box subscription that supports emerging Australian authors and their stories. Head to Molly's website, mollyscottage.com.au, or follow her and Reading by Candlelight on socials.